Mr. Banner, Tessman, tape one side two. Okay. Now, as far as the wind tunnel is concerned, so you were involved in constructing the wind tunnel?
No, not constructing the wind tunnel, not at all. Occasionally when some hardware, like a superstructure, was needed, you know, as a holder for the model, for models, or adjustable distance for models and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But normally I didn't have to do anything with it. Well, anyhow.
Mm-hmm. But you were located in the headquarters office?
I was very near the area, because the house four was so small, finally they threw me out because I did not work too well with Papa Riedel. A doctor from Brown transferred my whole branch to the test unit or whatever, I don't know,
test
the
organization.
Test organization. And it was under Dr. Walter Thiel. And with this man, I worked very nicely together later. I met Dr. Thiel already in Kummersdorf.
He came about when? 37 or so? Or
he also came in 1937 to Peenemünde. Because he continued his work in Kummersdorf for quite some time.
Yeah, I remember, and I've seen documents as well.
He continued
until
on his
40.
Four-ton engines, we called it.
But the I was under the impression that the 25-ton test couldn't be done until, 1940 or so? Or
no,
1939?
38 we had the very first test.
You're sure that was a 25-ton engine that was tested in 1938?
Yeah, it was a V2 engine, sure.
The very first version of it? Because Thiel stayed down in Kummersdorf until 1940 or so, didn't he? Most of the time, 39 or 40?
Could be. Could be 39, certainly he still was there, because in 1939 I was told, I didn't know, I was told later, Adolf Hitler had shown up in 39 in Kummersdorf, and they had given him a guided tour and had shown him a very simple test of a vertical small engine test line.
Probably a four-ton engine maybe or something. Certainly this. They couldn't do the 25-ton engine.
No.
At Kummersdorf.
There weren't any facilities. For this purpose, you need lots of instrumentation, and we had just a little bit in one of our trailers, you know, a very primitive Tintenschreiber. What do you call them? Tintenschreiber?
You're talking about a... I know what you mean. A pen, it's like a
right.
A pen roll or something would be a literal. I really can't think of the word myself. It won't come to me. But at any rate, so that you just had very primitive facilities.
And we didn't have enough water in this area because you need a Tennessee River, you know, to cool down the deflector. Even with a small engine, we had our problems.
You had problems pumping enough water?
Pumping enough water.
That was a consideration, too.
We were happy when we got our water through a 3/4-inch line just for drinking purpose, but not for any test purpose.
May I interrupt you?
Yes, go ahead, Mr. Heimberg.
When was test stand number 8? Well, because test stand number 8 was there for combustion chambers only.
Only, yes.
And my question to you is, wasn't the A4 engine checked out on test stand number 8 before it came as into the missile?
Not as a research engine. No, not as a research engine. Test stand number 8 took care of fabrication?
Okay, of the line.
Yeah. You can give the word in German if that comes to mind. But test stand number 8 was finished when, you think?
Yeah, well, it just came pretty soon after we had finished our test stand number 5, which was a pump test position. number 5, number 1, and in between was test in number 8. And we run this V2 engine in a whole centrifugal position.
Mm-hmm. So 8 was only for the production engines?
For production engines, that's the right word.
Which came out?
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. But the very first research V2 engine was on test stand number 1. I remember too well because I was asked by Mr. Schuler, Albert Schuler, he is a fellow worker of mine and a friend, you know, to help him to lay out or have get him a man to help him to lay out a thrust measuring system. And we really did it. But first we had to build a kind of a corset to put around the V2 in order to hold the V2 down on something and then connect the corset to some lever arms, you know, and that lever arm, of course, was connected to a pole which went down to the waage.
Scale.
Mm-hmm. And this was the Toledo scale, I remember.
Mm-hmm. So you had an American scale that you used?
Toledo? No, this is a company in Chicago. Not in Chicago, in
Toledo, Ohio.
In Toledo, no. Mm-hmm. It was not an American company, it was a German company in, now tell me, Stettin.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to say Swinemünde, but it's not right. Stettin. Toledo.
Probably was a German branch of the American company, because it was an American company.
Could be, yes. Mm-hmm.
But
with this young man, we worked together and worked out, and lots of changes had to be made. And then later, of course, some very wise crack, one guy out of my office said, why do you go through all this trouble? Don't you know that we have load cells on the market? You know, these load cells are electrically operated and give a signal to a kind of a recorder. And these load cells, it was easy. You just put in between the lever arm, which was connected to the corset, and the firm structure,
mm-hmm.
and where the whole V2 was resting on, so you could also measure the weight
mm-hmm.
of the V2.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, this test stand number 1, I have to tell you one sad story about. One day we had a mind to run a test. It was about 6 o'clock in the evening, but then the people from up there came.
Counterintelligence
came and said, no, you do not run a test that late. It was a little bit dark already because there are the airplanes up somewhere, you know. They will notice everything. So we had to stop. And the test engineer in charge, Kurt Heinisch, and Theodor Poppel, a Poppel old friend of mine, he passed away. He was late in Florida. He was the assistant test engineer. They were too lazy to empty out the V2. So they left the liquid oxygen into the tank too, because early in the next morning they wanted to continue to run the test. But if you leave the whole unit undercooled for such a long time, it shrinks the material. So between the vehicle and the corset, we had some knuckles, you know. They were pushed into some parts of the ring of the V2 structure. And now the V2 shrinked and these knuckles went out, so the whole vehicle slipped through the corset. The corset was hanging in the structure, mm-hmm. but the vehicle went down with its tail sitting on the water-cooled deflector.
Mm-hmm.
And, oh boy. I was sitting like in a courthouse. The deputy commander, General Sansen, he wanted to put me in front of a firing squad, something like this. He was a nasty character, I tell you. And then Werner von Braun tied himself. I didn't get much help from my boss because he didn't think much about me anyhow. Mm-hmm. So Werner von Braun came, and then we went through all the drawings, and then later we had proven that the design was perfect, was all right, you know.
That it was just the stupid mistake of somebody not to not to unload
the vehicle.
Now, do you remember when that was? Because it sounds like an instant. I've seen a memo from a very nasty memo from Dornberger. It's of the end of January 1942 about the very first A4, saying that it slipped and fell.
1942?
Beginning of 42. That's when the very first A4 was launched.
Oh, there was a launch from test set number 7.
Mm-hmm. No, I'm not talking about the first launch. I'm saying there's a memo from January 42 saying that the very first vehicle that never got launched because it was destroyed in March of 42 fell. Was that about when this incident happened?
No.
Or was this much later in the war?
It must have been earlier. Wait a second. It must have been earlier. I was in charge of, my branch was also in charge of the design of the international corset, we called it. The corset was used for maintenance to bring the vehicle up in the vertical position, for transportation, mm-hmm. for all kind of things, you know. And specifically, of course, for static test runs, mm-hmm. where you had something to hang on to put structure on. And
but you wouldn't have had a complete vehicle until the end of 41, I would say, right? The first complete V2 or A4 was finished around the end of 41 or something like that.
Oh, this could be the case, yes.
Yeah. Mr. Heimborg?
Wasn't there an accident while transporting the total vehicle from the ZV?
Yes.
To the test stand.
Yeah.
On the trailer. And the vehicle was destroyed.
Oh, Hans Hüder was in charge of it. Yeah.
That's what you are referring
to. Oh, this might be right. You know what happened? Out of the Zusammenbauwerkstatt, we were to take a complete V2 to the launch site, I don't know, maybe to the launch site or maybe to a test in number 1, I don't remember. Well, anyhow, it was put on the so-called Miler wagon. Mm-hmm. This was the only transportation vehicle for the complete V2, developed by the company Miler in Munich. And so there was a street next to the railroad track, parallel practically, but between the street and the railroad track there was a graben.
So ditch?
A ditch. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how this had happened. Well, anyhow, finally the truck left the road and came in a soft. And so with the Miler wagon, and the whole vehicle toppled over, and the V2 was in the ditch.
Mm-hmm. Was that later in the war sometime, or middle of the war?
I believe that was in 1942.
Oh, I really don't know.
Yeah,
I had nothing to do with it. Yeah. I only had sympathy for the fellow who was in charge of, mm-hmm. because there wasn't anything wrong with the Miler wagon. The Miler wagon was later even used by the troops.
Mm-hmm. But this incident of the slipping off the test stand 1 also happened, too, right? Where it slipped because it was left tanked up all night.
Yeah. It slipped. It was a complete vehicle.
And that was later on, or
because
was that early?
The tail compartment was bended entirely. Mm-hmm. And one of our later friends, too, he also was in Hansel, Otto Eisenhardt, you know, he was the master in the sheet metal shop, and he managed to get it clean and straight again.
Mm-hmm. That certainly sounds like the Sounds like the first vehicle to me. You know, the very first one, I think.
Must have been one of the very first one.
It so dropped.
It doesn't fit timelines properly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Because I also know that first vehicle was very unlucky because it also
now
blew up on
probably
the test stand,
I have
right?
to,
without ever being launched.
I probably have to correct something because we had run also, mm-hmm. when I said in May 1938, we also had run single engine tests. And for this purpose, we had a liquid LOX and fuel run tanks, you know. They were pressurized. We did not run with a complete power plant, so mm-hmm. no gas generator, no pumps, but only pressurized with N2, with nitrogen, these tanks, and made single engine, a typical R&D engine tests.
Mm-hmm.
And so often for this purpose, Dr. Thiel even had come to Peenemünde. Not that he was needed immediately, probably, I don't mm-hmm. know. I cannot say, but for his own personal interest and mm-hmm. knowledge.
Yeah, well, he would still be supervising those tests, I guess, too,
yes.
and
yes.
it would be under him. So those are that's what you think those very early tests of the 25-ton engine
this must
were,
have been,
just
yes.
a very sort of rough R&D
yeah.
development.
Well, anyhow, we had this Toledo thrust measurement device in operation already. And everyone, specifically Albert Schuller, he was so happy that the scale had mm-hmm. shown him
mm-hmm.
how it worked. You know, of course, through all these many adjustable hickeys, you know, you had lots of friction. And there was 10% or more even fault reading in, but he didn't mind. And pretty soon we found out anyhow because the so-called load cells and this Toledo thrust measurement device worked together one day. Mm-hmm. And so this was one unit checked the other unit, you know. And that's where he learned and we all learned.
Mm-hmm. I was interested by your comment about General Zanson. Or he later was a general. At that time, he would have been Colonel Zanson.
Yes, he was.
You didn't get along with him that well?
Well, yes, of course. He mm-hmm. he also could be very friendly, but it was, for him, it was the worst thing which could happen as a boss, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He was in charge of the overall when General Dornberger was in Berlin. So mm-hmm. it was must have been very frustrating to him.
Mm-hmm.
I could feel it today. I could know how it is.
I talking to a number of people, I got the impression some really got along with him or really liked him, and other people didn't get along with him.
Later, when he was invited by Werner von Braun mm-hmm. for a party, you know, at Werner von Braun's private home, mm-hmm. he was the most friendliest fellow, you know, and he came and took me in his arm and said, "Mr. Tesman, so mm-hmm. glad to see you again. Remember, I was so rough once, and I mm-hmm. still want to apologize."
Mm-hmm.
So he was a soft character. Almost tears had come out of his eyes.
Where was that? Was that in Huntsville?
That was in Huntsville, yes, in the new, in the new area where Dr. von Braun lived last.
Because, mm-hmm. you know, I met his daughters in Hamburg in last August, that he has two daughters who live in Hamburg. So I talked to him about his life, but I guess they were still a little unhappy about the way he got tossed out in 1943 as a result of accusations made by the Gestapo. You remember?
I don't know.
Yeah,
I never heard about it.
Yeah.
What was
a major? He was a responsible person in that.
I know only Hauptmann Harig.
No, not Harig.
No?
What was the name of Harig? Is that H-A-R?
H-A-R-R-I-G, Harig.
Yeah, I think what you're talking about is what I mentioned when I talked to you, is that Lieutenant Colonel Stegmeier.
Stegmeier, that is
the
one.
From the documents, I can see that he had a role, although nobody knew that at the time, in But Zanson was accused of being involved with opposition people in the Catholic Church, by the Gestapo and SS, and I've seen the documents that show that the Himmler sort of became involved in April, May 43 in this accusation against Sanson. They never proved any of these accusations, but Sanson went away.
I really was.
After that.
I never had much to do with later General Sanson at all.
Mm-hmm.
But I was assigned a bicycle, you know, to go around in the whole area. And once a month there was a Appell, as we call it. There was Hauptmann Harek was in charge of, so he had to look over the bicycles whether they were really shiny and clean. And my bicycle was so dirty. And boy, he reported it in writing to the commander. So I again had to see Sanson, you know. Before I went in his office, I saw his secretary, and his secretary still is today with us. Mm-hmm. It was Mrs. Lotschendrabe was his secretary.
And how was the name spelled? Because I have to write these things down on the transcript. I don't want to get them right. How is the name?
Drabe.
Drabe.
Mm-hmm.
It was his secretary.
What was the last name?
D-R-A-W-E.
Uh-huh, Drabe, okay.
And then I entered his office. Boy, I come closer, and he was there, you know. And he was hollering around at me. And he came closer and closer to me, so I dared to take my handkerchief and dry my face. And then he got so red in his face, and his voice got louder and louder.
All over a bicycle.
All over the bicycle, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I was not a military person, you know. I was in civil clothes.
So,
and he must have hated us. That was my impression.
He was uncomfortable with the civilian scientists, or Johnson was uncomfortable with the civilians. They're not military.
It was finally my feeling.
Yeah. Did you know Stegmeier at all?
I had met him once. A very wonderful, friendly fellow man.
Mm-hmm.
And I had some work to do with some of his people, Hauptmann Hoffmann.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was in charge to put the first battery together for the V2 launch site.
Mm-hmm.
A 3 aggregate battery. And I was sitting with my office after the air raid in Kölpinsee. This is one of the little villages along the Gulf line. The coastline.
Mm-hmm.
There was Peenemünde, Karlshagen, Trassenheide, Zempin, and then Kölpinsee. That's where I lived and had my office.
Mm-hmm.
We occupied a restaurant and put all the drawing boards in the mm-hmm. beautiful restaurant.
Mm-hmm. That was after the air raid.
That's where I was put in charge, because not facilities had been built and planned so much anymore. So the office, since I had designers, mechanical engineers, they were put in charge of to put ground equipment together.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, one of the master designers, he got a heart attack recently, Theo Fove, he designed the complete launch table of the Miler wagon. You know, the launch table was attached to the wagon, and when you erected the vehicle, it was immediately put on the launch table. Now, it was a pretty complicated deal, because the launch table had to be revolved this way in order to put the vehicle in the right azimuth, they call it.
Yeah.
So we had to launch over a distance of, what was it, 250 miles, and the azimuth had to be put in very accurate,
mm-hmm.
by millimeters, you could say.
Really? That's how closely you measured the ring.
It was pretty complicated. Now, this had to be turned on the other side. You had so many other hardware higgies attached to, for instance, the cable mast arm. know, after the command was given, the cable mast swung back and fall down. Now, of course, you can do this only in the right position and not in the leaning side position.
Mm-hmm.
So that fellow had to sweat it out. All kind of requirements had come up at the same time. You know, the army, of course, they had to depend on power they developed from their own generators. And the power current was delivered to the vehicle. In order to run the gyroscope, you had to bring cables up to the instrumentation section. And there was, as we called it, a big Stutzstecker, you know, with all
like
kind of
yeah.
all kind of electrical connections. And that, before you gave a firing command, had to come out to be pulled out. And this was a spring action, of course, a very simple spring action. And things like this. But then later again, facility planning came up. Personally, I was then involved again in facility planning in Austria
mm-hmm.
and Vöcklabruck. No, this was earlier. I mean in Gmunden, Ebensee. You know, where we had in mind to have underground facilities and just one, like our static test tower at Redstone Arsenal outside, where we would install the complete V2 underground, get it out into the test position, run a test, and get it back again.
Mm-hmm. That was that the facility that had the code name Cement?
Oh, yes, sir, Cement, you are right.
Mm-hmm.
It was near Gmunden. Mm-hmm. There was a very huge lake, Ebensee, E-B-E-N-C,
mm-hmm.
a most beautiful area. Mountain area. Oh, it was great.
Is that, that's...
Each time I had to go on business trip, I was so happy. I was like, I go on vacation.
Mm-hmm. That was in, is that in Upper Austria or Lower Austria, or is it over towards the Tyrol? I just don't even, I don't know where that is really.
A shame, but I couldn't even tell you anymore.
Yeah. So you were involved in planning that underground facility,
but,
right?
But, you know, I only can tell you it was not very far away from Vienna because I had business in Vienna Neustadt.
Mm-hmm.
In Vienna Neustadt we had a liquid oxygen plant and occasionally I was called over. I don't know why, I was not an expert,
mm-hmm.
but I had connections. So I called in our expert, Mr. George Utpadel.
How would you spell that?
U-T-P-A-T-E-L. U-A-L. George Utpadel.
U-T-U-P-T-A.
U-T.
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 Yeah.
Utpadel.
Para.
Patel. P-A-T-E-L.
Okay. Utpadel. Okay. It's a hard name.
I don't know what was,
an unusual
I don't know
name.
What was wrong. Anyhow, he had come and he straightened out. Something was wrong with the byproduct. You know, if you produce liquid oxygen, you get as a bypass gases, oxygen, of course, and gases N2 and nitrogen. Be used as a pressurant, you know, for the LOX tank and fuel tank.
Mm-hmm. But you use the nitrogen in the production in cooling down and let it go as a gas again. Mm-hmm. So you
right.
do not use, the ratio is 1 in 4 parts. So you use it in cooling since you have start out with liquid air.
Yeah.
And then you distill the liquid air. And in doing that, you use the cold, the liquid nitrogen, in order to cool down
again,
the incoming air.
Mm-hmm. Right, so that you recycled the nitrogen.
Well, something probably did not recycle correct. And well, anyhow, George finished this job, and I had to continue to go to Project Seaman. Oh, by the way, Project Seaman, there was Papa Riedel again. He was put in charge to collect all the informations, you know, and keep contact with an architect office at this time, which was selected, I don't know by whom. I even never met any gentleman of this architect's office, but only dealt with my former boss, Walter Riedel.
Mm-hmm. Was Riedel down there at Gmunden, or was he in Peenemünde?
No, he was then down in Gmunden.
Mm-hmm. That would have been in 1943 or 1944.
Oh, that was very late, yes, very late, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had a question that regards him. I don't have this story quite straight yet, but he was more or less supplanted by Walter Riedel III, I gather, as chief designer.
Yes, yes.
About 42.
And was it 42?
I think so. Mm-hmm. I think it was 42. And then I was told, and I don't remember anyone who remember now who told me the story, that he was put on this production drawings project with Stahlknecht, the so-called Nachbau.
Stahlknecht.
Yeah, Nachbau Direktion.
Nachbau.
Yeah, and that didn't work out very well.
Yes,
you
are right. This was involved in, and he had his office not in House 4 at this time anymore. They put him in a kind of a uniform, and I don't know, inspector uniform, I don't know. Anyhow, he didn't feel too well, and I felt kind of sorry for him a little bit, because he lost his position, and he was not that bad, because technically he was okay, he was good, no mm-hmm. question about it.
Yeah, I've been told that he came into conflict with people partly because he wouldn't get along with diplome ingenieur and so forth. He didn't like people with big titles or doctor ingenieur. That's what a couple of people have told me, that he didn't get along with some people, I guess. Huh?
I think he was once in a while a real stubborn.
That's a right expression. You know, little things, he got so carried away.
Carried away with little things.
Mm-hmm.
And that made him intolerable for others who said, I cannot work with him.
One day I remember, you know, whenever a set of drawings was finished, I was supposed to see him so he could initial and approve it more or less. And then once he took his finger and pointed to one bolt or something, he said, Tess, that's wrong. That must be wrong. That cannot take the force. You know, I said, Mr. Riedel, hold a second. I made personally the calculation. I just know all the equations too well. And by the way, to be sure, I went to Mr. Wettin. He was our master stress analyst.
Mm-hmm.
And I had him check this over again. And he turned this over to another later friend of mine, Emil Hellebrand. And he checked it over. He said, that's fine. You have quite a good safety margin. And so I went back and told him the whole story, what I had to go and how much time I lost on account of his remark. And he got so darn mad, he threw me out. And this was probably the last time I went into his office.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow it was carried to Werner von Braun.
That was general. It was not only one case on your side, the rest of us who had difficulties to work with him, including Thiel.
So Papa Riedel was more or less displaced because he couldn't get along with people that well. And is it true that when he was transferred to Nachbau that there was a problem with this first version of production drawings, or did you know anything about that at all?
No.
Mm-hmm.
No.
And so later on, he then turned up with this Project Cement.
That's where they put him. They needed someone who had enough knowledge about the overall, and this, no doubt, was Mr. Riedel, Papa Riedel.
Uh-huh. The plan with the cement was to move the facility from Peenemünde underground, the whole facility, or just a part of it? underground?
Even that had nothing to do with Peenemünde at this time, I think.
Mm-hmm.
It was just another plan, you know, to in case of an emergency, so we could continue with production of hardwares and simulation tests, ground component simulation tests.
This was a different organization, right? Completely independent from Peenemünde. Rikai.
Oh, yeah, Rikai, yeah.
Was the one who was in charge of this organization. And if he needed help, he called on Peenemünde, and Peenemünde had to send somebody to help him out. But the organization was absolutely separated from Peenemünde.
Mm-hmm. So you think that that facility was a part of Mittelwerk, or was under Mittelwerk?
Under Mittelwerk.
Yeah, because I'm not clear on that. Seems like on some places it... They're saying that they wanted to evacuate Peenemünde to cement. Of course, in the end, it was never used.
I never heard about this story.
Yeah.
No,
it's maybe.
And
not,
I was so close to it.
Let me interrupt you once more. It could be that Dr. Schilling, I do not know if you ever heard his name.
Sure, of course.
That he knows details about that. Schilling did eventually know.
Oh yeah. You are so right.
And Schilling is still alive.
He's still alive. I have his address if you need it, even his telephone. Yeah,
where does he live? He lives in
Lexington.
In Massachusetts.
Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think he would be an important person to be interviewed.
You can ask him, I believe. Mm-hmm. These are details Schilling knows.
Mm-hmm. So as far as you're concerned, that was always a facility that was supposed to be from Mittelwerk or something.
Yeah.
It was an underground. And I know that in the end, they used it as a tank factory or something. That's what I've read, at any rate. It was converted in 1944 in the last days of the war.
But actually, during all the time I had to go to the place, nothing was under construction.
Yeah.
Nothing.
That would have been in 43. Probably.
There was even not an architectural office or a construction office.
Mm-hmm.
It was only Mr. Riedel, you know, he had a one-room office where he collected all kind of information, specifically sketches and drawings my office made proposals, you know, about how to do it. And in this area, also another friend who passed away, architect by profession, Mr. Hannes Lürsen, was very much involved in this project.
Is that Lürsen?
Lürsen, yes.
Yeah, I think I know.
Lürsen, Lürsen, Hannes Lürsen.
Mm-hmm. So...
the planner of our Memorial Parkway.
Mm-hmm.
In Huntsville.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
People, the business people
he
didn't
was a
like
very
it
good
at
architect,
all.
But as a character, lousy.
Yeah. Another person who was difficult to get along with. Well, Papa Riedel came back to Peenemünde later in the war, or did he stay down there? Or,
No, I don't remember. I was already in Landshut at this time.
But I mean, after Gemünden in 43, 44, 45.
I never have seen him anymore. I was very, very happy when my wife wrote me a letter. I was in Aberdeen already in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And when she wrote, Mr. Riedel had shown up in Landshut, and we took care of him. My wife and another Mrs. Schulz invited him for lunch, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And he at this time didn't know where to go.
Mm-hmm.
So they probably, my wife thought he tried to go back to some close area to Peenemünde, because somewhere in this area he was supposed to have his family, his wife and a son.
Yeah, he went to Britain.
Son and a daughter.
Yeah.
Wonderful kids he had, a wonderful wife.
Yeah, but he ended up working in Britain. For the rest of his life. Yeah. Walter Riedel won, that is.
Walter Riedel won.
Yeah. I'm trying to remember. Were you there when in the first A4s?
were launched in 1942. Do you remember the very first launches?
Oh, yeah, I remember this too. I was on top of the Tesla number one platform, you know, the concrete platform. And with another fellow worker called Pat, he's not alive anymore either. We just want to see it from direct short side without looking through a binoculars. That was nasty anyhow. And you want to have the overall impression. So, but the launch site was not very far away. So it was a beautiful takeoff. A countdown, everything was fine. And the takeoff was so clean and clear. And suddenly the whole darn Grandma V2 started to wiggle over into our direction. And later we were told the pump or the gas generator kicked out, and so the pump didn't deliver to the combustion chamber any material, so it just dropped like a rock, but very close by, and it was quite an explosion. It was a, like you take a paper bag, you know, blow it up, and hit it again. That was one of the first launches. And then there was another one, very almost the same picture, where General Dornberger and quite a number of other officers were on top of our one of our large assembly building close by to Tesla number 7. And finally the vehicle also moved over into their direction. And one of the engineers told me later, you should have seen our general, how he took a powder, and all his people, you know.
dive for cover at that point.
There was not much to dive for, but at least they jumped back into the opening, you know, where it let down some staircases to a safety area.
It sounds like you were lucky never have one fall back directly on top of Test Stand 1 or something, that it could have happened.
One destroyed very much our pump station for the Test Stand number 7 double side deflector.
But do you remember the first successful launch, the famous one in October 42?
I think I remember talking about it, but I haven't seen it from near distance. I probably heard it from the beach in Sinovitz, you know, because all the visitors, the vacationers, suddenly, you know, they were standing and listening. And sure enough, the rumble came through to the point, and I knew it was a launch. And pretty soon after, you could even see a tail section coming up, the long tail of the flame, the jet.
In other words, there were still people going to the beach resorts there.
Yes,
until the air raid when they evacuated everybody. The beach resorts.
Sinovitz was a very famous place. We had huge hotels and wonderful, very tasteful arrangements, you know, and restaurants, very nice. That's where I spent my best years.
So there was a lot of, so it was a nice area in terms of facilities. I think sometimes the picture of the place is given as so isolated, people have forgotten that, in fact, it had been at least down the island, and Sinovitz and farther had been a beach resort.
When you went down from Sinovitz, and then you know Kosovo, Banzin, Bad Banzin, and then Heringsdorf, Aalbeck, and finally the huge city, Swinemünde. It was great. It was just beautiful. Today, even the East people, East Berlin, they visit this area very often whenever they have a chance to get reservations.
That's a summer, the summer resort, the summer
the
beach resort.
The daughter of a friend of mine, she lives in East Berlin, and she and her husband spent their summer vacation mostly very close to where I used to live, in Sinovitz or in Kosovo, or Icarus.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that a lot, many of you lived that far down towards those beach resorts, right?
Oh, yeah.
Even earlier in the war.
And that's where our wagbahn, our little train, I call it a milk can collector, you know, wherever you had seen five or ten houses, the train was stopping and some people came and loaded the plane and then it continued to the next little
stop. That was a local train that was used as a kind of commuter train.
Huh? Very loud and stinky diesel locomotive and some very old cars from the German Reichsbahn, you know, they got for nothing practically. Boy, they were so cold and so loud. You always thought they had seven or five corners on their wheels. But since I was in this business, one day I stepped out and looked at the wheels, but they looked so nice and round to me, so I couldn't understand the noise level. But they must have put up the track in 10-foot sections instead of, as it used to be, in 50 to 60-foot sections.